It was wonderful to catch up with Sarah Blackman, who is the latest guest in my series of Nostalgia Interviews. Sarah is a University of Kent alumnus. I taught her a few years ago on the BA Religious Studies programme. She tells us that when she was 5 years of age, she informed her mother that she wanted to become a primary school teacher. We find out why it took her so long to fulfil her ambition. Sarah talks about her childhood memories, the power games that children play around invitations. We discuss the differences between children's behaviour at school and at home. Sarah recalls doing her homework to the sound of Mark Goodyear on Radio 1 on a Sunday evening, counting down the top 40, and the skills of categorising and classifying information. We find out what her reaction was when she learned that S Club 7 had beaten Madonna to reach number 1 in the UK singles charts. We talk about Sarah's experiences of school, and she tells us why her RE supply teacher was such an inspiration. She talks about the blood, sweat and tears involved in writing essays at university, and about how she has been able to apply her university work to her present job. Sarah tells us about her obsession with the programme Friends, and why when it came out in the mid-90s she watched Toy Story every night on VHS. We also discuss the way in which school children today are more aware of changes in the environment, climate change for example, and Sarah talks about voting in elections. She tells us why she studied religious studies and what people would often say to her when she told them what she was studying. She talks about looking at the past through rose-coloured spectacles and the way we filter out more negative experiences. And we learn why Sarah thinks she has righted in her 30s some of the wrongs she made when she was in her 20s. Then in the final part of the interview, Sarah talks about Santa Claus the movie, why it is such an important film for her. And we move on to consider the concept of Christmas more broadly as sacred time. And then we find out whether Sarah is in touch with friends from her past and whether she is a looking back or a looking forward type of person. So what a huge privilege to catch up this week with Sarah Blackman. Welcome to the latest in my series of Nostalgia Interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is such a pleasure to meet up with Sarah Blackman, and we were just talking before we started that it's 3 years since I last saw you on graduation day.
Yes, you were in religious studies. 2016, yes, in the Darwin Rose Garden, wasn't it, at the party? Yeah.
And you probably got lots of prizes, I think, that day, didn't you?
I did get a couple,
a couple, I remember. But all I remember is we were having a conversation, then you went up and we talked a bit, then you went up to get another. It was like, you know, well, come on, you know, which is more important, getting your prize or finishing a conversation? But no, that was amazing. And what do you do now, Sarah?
So I teach year one and two at primary school in East Sussex. So when I graduated in 2016, I did a primary PGCE at Canterbury Christ Church. And I'm about to go into my third year of working in that same school where I did my first year. So, yeah.
Is that something you always wanted to do? I mean, teaching is something that so many students on the course.
Yes.
I always find that I'm writing references for PGCEs all the time. But was this something that you always wanted to do after the degree, or did it sort of through happenstance?
When I was 5 years old, I told my mum that I was going to be a primary school teacher. Yeah. And then when I was 31, I finally qualified. So I'm a real kind of seize the moment kind of person. But I think as I became kind of a older teenager, I don't know, I lost a little bit of confidence. Possibly why I didn't go to university straight away, even though I could have. And in the end, it just became like, you know, this little niggle that I want to teach isn't going away, so let's do it.
But I think what you said is really interesting, because sometimes it's not a bad thing just to say, I'll do whatever I do, I'll do it when I'm ready to do it.
Yes.
Rather than the idea that you have to do it the moment you hit the age of 21 or whatever.
So, although still a little bit of a risk, isn't it? Like, I look back and think, oh, gosh, you know, anything could have happened in those kind of 9 years that I didn't do it for. So actually, I'm quite grateful that I still had the opportunity to go and do it.
But there are lots of things that you can't do, well, you can do later, but it's more of a struggle. I mean, for example, I'm so glad I did my PhD when I was in my early 20s, but there's no way I could do that now. But I've got another friend who works here who plans to go into teaching, and I think so it's a real sort of late career move.
Yes,
but again, it's something that she's been hankering after for a long time, and probably thought for a long time, oh, it's never going to work out. Or, you know, I'd like to do that, but, you know, I'm too busy with X, Y, and Z, and it's too big a risk to sort of uproot. But sometimes if you really need to do something, you're going to end up doing it anyway.
Yes, yeah.
So you graduated in religious studies.
I did.
And tell me a little bit then about sort of your background, where and when you were born.
So I was born in Ashford, and I've pretty much stayed there throughout university. And even when I worked in London, I still commuted from where I was born. And I went to the local grammar school and stayed there until year 13 and did my A-levels, and then was just thought university was far too terrifying. So I did a job in Ashford for a few years and then went and worked in London. And then it was like, I want more than this. Yeah. So, you know, university had always been kind of nagging me since I'd left school, really. So it was kind of a case of now or never. I had no real kind of commitment still. So it was kind of the ideal time to just...
One thing that a lot of people talk about in the interview is this notion of imposter syndrome. You know, the sort of idea people say, oh, I can't possibly do that. I'm not ready to do that. Or I don't feel... or people are going to find out that I'm not really good enough to do a particular course. But often people who have that... are often excel because they have to try that much harder, rather than this sense of, oh, I'm so amazing, I'm brilliant, I'm going to sail through, I don't have to do any work. Mm. People with that sense are more likely to go to lectures, more likely to make sure their essays are in by the deadline, and more likely to thrive because they know that, and it's something that's clearly from within, because no one else, including in yourself, because you were producing exceptional work. But I can imagine that you were someone who, even in your third year, when it was obvious to us that you were going to get a brilliant degree, my guessing is that you lacked that sense of confidence.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. But going back to what you were saying about kind of not just going with it and thinking I was going to succeed without having to really try, I think also being a little bit older and kind of having done work that I haven't sort of really wanted to do, I appreciated it so much. Like, it felt like a real privilege to kind of be able to, on days when there were no lectures, go to spend all day in the library and kind of read about a subject that I was really, really fascinated by and interested in, and start forming my own arguments for the essays and things. So in some ways, it's easy to look back and regret not doing it when I did, but then maybe I wouldn't have had the experience that I did have when I was here.
And is that something that, I mean, in your family, did anyone else go to university, or were you a sort of a trailblazer in that sense?
No, so nobody in my immediate family went to university. Actually, funny enough, my younger brother did go before I did. He came here and he ended up changing his course, and then we ended up graduating a day apart from each other. So
I remember you telling me now, actually.
So he's 6 years younger, but he graduated the day before me.
So tell me a little bit about earliest memories. How far can you go back to? What can you remember from childhood? Some people can't go back that far.
I think my very first memory, I was about 3 years old. I was having a little birthday party with my teddy bears, and I sat on a balloon and it popped. So that's probably my very first memory.
Was that traumatic?
A little bit, yeah.
Because I've got four children, but one of them will be very happy to go around popping a balloon and enjoy it when other people get frightened, whereas some of the others will hate it and burst into tears. So because I reckon that when I was young, I must have been stung by a wasp, because I've always had this fear of needles.
Okay.
And wasps don't... You know, don't do it for me at all. Some people are frightened of spiders or rats. It's that. So it's very interesting that something like that can happen at a young age. Mm. But it's kind of the sort of thing that
it might not have even happened. Yeah. I just remember it.
Yeah, but I've got these sort of memory experiences which I can't trace. I'm imagining that something happened, but I've blocked it, or I was too young to remember it. What about things that you enjoyed doing as a child?
So I love visiting my grandparents. None of them are here now, so. You know, I look back on that with a lot of fondness, going to visit them, having them come to us. I enjoyed playing with cars.
Was it sort of like Christmas presents, that sort of thing, or toy cars going around a circuit?
Just little toy ones, and I used to kind of make them go down my slide in the back garden.
But it's really funny, isn't it? Because there's these like generic experiences that all children have.
Mm.
But I've got two boys and two girls, but it doesn't always follow that it's the girls sometimes who are more interested in doing that sort of thing than the boys. Mm. And you sort of look back and you, but at nursery sometimes I'll say like, oh, do you play with so-and-so? And they'll say, no, because he's a boy and we don't play with boys. Aww. That sort of thing.
I do remember actually getting this boy in my class, I must have been about year three or four or something, invited everybody in the whole class, boys and girls, to his party. And I just remember sobbing because it was a boy. I didn't want to go to a boy's party.
Yeah.
And I couldn't go.
Yeah. But you see, the funny thing is that sometimes, whether it's a boy or a girl, there's this real almost like territorial thing with children. Maybe it was the same when I was young. I don't remember going to that many parties.
Mm.
But some of my daughters tend to go to more than the boys do. But if the boys know that their elder sister's going to party, they just assume that they're invited.
Yes.
And they sort of go along and just assume that, because obviously you have to take them all with you and the other two play, or they pay for them separately, or play in a different room. But they've got no sort of sense of social etiquette, and why would they? Because they're only four.
Yeah.
But that is interesting, isn't it? But from a young age, the way that there's this notion of best friends.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And the worst thing is, when it's like, so-and-so is my best friend today, then the next day, so I'm not her best friend today, she didn't want to play with me. But I think
I know that scenario well from my job as well.
Yeah.
And the worst thing you can say to your best friend is, you're not invited to my birthday party anymore.
Yeah.
That is like the ultimate weapon.
Yeah. And is that used a lot by the children as their way of almost sort of showing their... I mean, is it a power thing? I don't know. Or is it just... I mean... It's funny, isn't it? Even at adults sometimes, that sort of notion of... You even have it in politics, like Sajid Javid. You know, he wasn't invited to the big banquet when Donald Trump visited. But that sort of notion of, you know, of what happens when you kind of feel that there's a clique, or you kind of feel that there are the important people, and you're clearly not, because so-and-so got an invitation and you didn't.
Mm.
And then you've got to almost sort of then recover from that notion that somehow you're not deemed by somebody... To be a very important person. But if you're in the profession that you're in, you must see that all the time. How do you manage that?
Obviously, you have to kind of discuss strategies that perhaps you would use, and talk about, you know, all the PSHE things that we've discussed, about being kind to others and trying... Because it's difficult for them to see from someone else's point of view at that age. But you sort of have to discuss how that person might feel and...
But parents, though, do the parents come into play? Do you ever have any dealings with parents? I guess you do
quite a lot of the time, yeah.
And it must be very hard sometimes, because they obviously, parents always want the best for their children. But often, of course, what they think is the best for their child is not the best for you, when you've got to look up and make sure all the children are treated equally. You can't sort of let a very pushy parent dictate the pace.
So far, I've been quite lucky on that front. And actually, I think the key is communication. So if someone has been upset by a friend or anything like that, you know, the key is you tell them before they hear it from somebody else, and you let them know that you're dealing with it. And then you give them an update maybe a couple of days later, perhaps, you know, have they been as upset at home or something like that. So I think they can see that I do sort of still track it and keep an eye on it.
But it's really interesting, because I find that sometimes at school or nursery, my children can be like really well behaved, or the teachers will say, it's fine, they had a really good day, and you're thinking, oh my word. But as soon as they're outside of that space, all hell breaks loose. And either, and I guess it's better that way around, because if they were really disruptive in class, then the teachers can't do their job, the other pupils don't get taught.
Yeah.
But sometimes when they're home, I think, there's no way you're like this at school, are you? So why are you like this now?
You get that all the time. So if at parents' evening, I say, oh, they're just so well behaved, they're such a joy, and you're like, are you sure? Are you talking about the right child here? I think that's quite a common thing.
Yeah. No, and I wonder if children often seem a lot... I mean, they're like sponges sometimes. I'm very conscious of what they pick up at a young age. And I'm frightened of that, you know, they will remember things, even if they're like five or six. So probably about the age that the pupils that you're teaching.
Yeah.
But even, you know, something that happened when they were like two or three, like birthdays, or when they were ill one day, or they fell on the stairs or something like that. They remember all this, and they also associate it with periods of the year. Like, they know that it was on their birthday that they were feeling unwell because they had too much cake, but they know that it was that birthday and not the next birthday because they were with a friend or whatever it was. So they're able to categorize and demarcate. As adults, I work with, you know, my memory's not perfect, although I do keep a diary, but I often find that I'm talking to other adults, you know, a bit of colleagues I work with, and I'll refer to something that happened 3-4 years ago, or teaching a particular module, or some event that we all went to, and, you know, they've got no recollection of it. Or it could have been 5 months ago, it could have been 5 years, could have been 15 years ago. And I think, but my children seem to have a better grasp.
I don't know, I think maybe when you've still got that developing working memory, you use those kind of milestones, those big events, and that's how you kind of track back to when certain things happen. It's quite interesting. I used to be really good, so like if I was talking to my husband or a friend and we said, oh, when did that happen? I'll just have to think about the essay that I was working on at the time to know when that was. Yeah. But now, if someone said, when did we go and visit that place? And I think, oh gosh, how many months ago was that? And there's not really much to kind of mark out when that was. Yeah.
And it's really interesting you say that, because I find that, because I always used to have the radio on when I was working on my degree, and I can associate particular songs, particular presenters, particular news stories with those essays that I was working on. And the funny thing is that I find that I'm able to, you know, as time goes on, I find that sometimes if I'm listening to the radio and there are these like pop quizzes, I can do a really good job. I know the answers to this, and but the reason I know all this pop music trivia is because I was working on an assignment. Mm. And it's almost as though I was taking all of that very seriously. I was, you know, soaking up all the, you know, the books and synthesizing them and assembling them and doing all these wonderfully scholarly things. But then it might be, you know, My Old Man's a Dustman or something else on the radio. But the two of them are indissolubly fused in my mind. But I also think it's a strange, almost like, is it a skill? But it's, but in a different, completely different context, you can remember things from a, you know, from, but nobody else could make that same association.
And so kind of in the 90s, you know, early 2000s, when I was, you know, doing my homework on a Sunday, I'd have the Top 40 on with Mark Goodyear on Radio 1. And I used to kind of always know who was at number one. And then kind of more recently, we used to go to this pub quiz, and everyone would be like, right, Sarah, 90s music's coming on. You're going to know this. And so sometimes they would play like the first bar of a song, and I'd know exactly what it was because those are the ones that I'd kind of grown up with and listened to every single week.
Yeah, no, and I was going to then ask that very thing about whether the charts were instrumental in your growing up. It's for me that way, and it's perhaps strange in a way because, you know, to have gone from listening to the Top 40 at the age of, you know, from six or seven onwards, for me, like very much of 1981 sort of thing. I was 8 years old, and I saw all the sort of, before your time, but Adam and the Ants and Shakin' Stevenson, Toya and all, UB40, and, you know, all this stuff was completely bound up with that childhood. But I can also remember particular events like Charles and Diana's wedding. Mm. And I do remember, you know, remember Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister. I remember the Falklands of 82. But again, it's very much around the sort of the sounds of the time.
Yes.
But writing down the charts, and it only occurred to me later that it's the same skill that I use or have used over the years in academia. Because if you're going to write something down, because I've always been somebody who, you know, everything, you know, I've always kept a diary. But if you're listening to the charts and you go into that effort, you might, in my case, you know, I'd use different colours for, you know, is it a new entry? Is it going up? Is it going down? But again, that sense of putting everything into some sort of order.
Mm.
Do the degree some years later, and it's exactly the same thing. You're categorising and classifying everything. So one is arguably trivia, and the other is very serious stuff.
Yes.
But actually, it's the same skill. It's just appropriated in a different way. You know, one is sort of more recreational, and the other one is sort of more the day job sort of thing.
Well, let's do it. Still got that critical thinking. How did that get to number one?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. But also, I don't know if you had that as well in the playground. You know, you'd have a favourite song, and if your song made it to number one, and somebody,
it was the best feeling.
Yeah, and so can you remember any particular songs that in this, you know, that you grew up with? Any particular, any fallings out or not being invited to birthday parties because you didn't like the same artist, whoever the artists were?
I remember walking to school with a friend of mine, and S Club 7 had just released their first single, and they were up against Madonna.
Yeah.
At the same time, and we was on this Monday morning after S Club 7 had actually beat Madonna to number one, we were just so happy because we'd watched them. They'd had a TV program. I think it was called Miami 7 or something. And so we were just so happy that this new band had actually beat Madonna to number one.
Yeah, and that actually appeared on, but I recorded, when I was at university, I used to record all this stuff on the radio. Most of the stuff is sort of music from the 50s to the 80s, but certainly Radio 2 didn't play much contemporary music in the 90s and onwards. It's a bit different now, but S Club 7 came out just the other night. It was that Don't Stop, that one. Is that, I don't know if that was the same one. That would have been early 2000s,
yeah,
late,
I think,
90s.
So. Yeah.
And the S, the Don't Blah 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 to the S Club beat. So
that's,
you know,
yeah,
the one,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. But isn't that interesting? So, and which was the Madonna song? Can you remember?
No. I'm going to have to look that up now.
Yeah. But in terms of, because I don't know if that sort of same dynamic happens now, because the charts, they come out on a different day of the week for a start. And of course, it's downloads.
Oh, it's so different. And it's fabulous. I don't understand.
But then
it,
there was a commute, because I saw the film Fisherman's Friends a few months ago, which although it's set, I think it's only set like 6-7 years ago, they're all huddled in this small Cornish village around the radio on a Sunday as they wait to see whether this atypical band of the local fishermen who put on this performance, which is so out of step with the sort of, you know, contemporary rock and pop sounds.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
And they're all, and it's obviously, if it's Joe Wiley is doing the voice and obviously doesn't do the charts. But it's the idea that, and but this is the thing. It takes me back. You mentioned Mark Goodyear, and I remember I wrote to Mark Goodyear once, actually. Yeah, so how do I do what you're doing? But Bruno Brooks, and before that, you know, Simon Bates. But listening to the charts on a Sunday. But I was huddled around my radio set writing it down. But all my friends seemed to be as well, and that's my recollection. And what it strangely did was bring us all together.
Yes,
that we were in our own spaces with our own families and doing in different parts of Cardiff, doing our own thing. But we all knew that when a particular song came on, we were then thinking of that friend who liked that, and that we knew that in the morning we'd be la 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 la, you know, that sort of thing. And I feel, I mean, obviously, you know, my children are a different generation, but I've got no interest in the music that they listen to now, to the point that I made a point of looking to see what was number one when they were born, and it didn't register.
No.
And yet, you give, well, I don't try this on me, but, you know, if you were to give a date or, you know, certainly a month anyway of the 70s or 80s, I'd probably, you know, there's a fair chance that I'd be in the right sort of ballpark. So it's kind of, so there's something, but I guess now that we have social media, quite rightly, those young children have now got a different way.
You haven't got, I don't know if you've got so much of that wait until 7 o'clock on a Sunday. Yeah. You know, even new releases, you haven't got to go to the shop and buy it anymore. It's just so instant, isn't it?
And I always think, and it's the same often now I do cinema trips a lot, it's the journey there. Going to the record, the effort of saying, I really like this song. I heard it on the radio.
Yes.
When does it come out? It comes out a week Monday. So on that Monday, you or your parents would go to HMV or Woolworths. Yeah, Our Price. And they used to open in the, and again, the days before download and so on, they'd open earlier because Monday was always the release date. And for, certainly for videos, as it used to be like, I remember, I think it was when The Lion King came out in the mid-90s, they'd open up, especially instead of opening up at 9 o'clock in the morning, they'd open at 8 o'clock.
I don't remember that.
So people could go to the store to get their advance copies before going to work or school.
Yeah.
So it'd be a special, you know, if you want your copy of The Lion King, you can get it before the school run. Right, you can't possibly wait till the end of the day. But again, something's missed. And Pulp Fiction, when that came out, I remember that was a real sort of, you know, everybody was like waiting for that date. But there's something missing now because it's too instantaneous. You like something, you can just download it. You take the effort away and everything seems much more ephemeral. On the one hand, technologically, it's better. And great if you want to get hold of some of that older stuff as well. It's hard to track down. But there's something that the magic is gone.
There was something about having that CD in your hand, wasn't there? Yeah. And maybe even going with friends to go and buy it or something. It became kind of that communal, it had that social function almost. Which, as you say, now seems to have gone because now you can download it all on your own in front of your computer. You might still talk to your friends about it. I don't really know. Yeah. But that magic's certainly gone, I think. I agree.
And how then, you've already mentioned obviously how you ended up sort of going into teaching, or it was a more sort of circuitous route.
Yeah.
But what about when you yourself were at school, any particular teachers that inspired you? You know, is there anything that made you say, I want to be, I mean, you're a primary school teacher, obviously your degree was religious studies. But was there a certain sort of like subject-based passion or a style of teaching or delivery that made you think, I could do that?
I'm not sure. I think I just, well, so not at the beginning, to be fair, you know, there was lots of tears and things dropping me off at the gate. And I remember the dinner ladies telling me that you're going to be at school for many, many years, and me being completely distraught. Yeah. But once I was kind of over that, I absolutely loved school. And I think I just always wanted to be there, apart from when I had the blip in confidence and then didn't go for it.
I've got particular teachers, secondary school, who really inspired me. But when I look back, they were inspiring because they engaged with us. They weren't necessarily, and they wouldn't get away with it now if I'm honest, but they weren't really teaching us a curriculum necessarily. We liked them because they kind of allowed us, I mean, we had an English teacher and his classes were always exciting and they always tended to be at the end of the day for some reason. So, you know, it was almost like we can't wait for 3 o'clock, that last hour. And we would have like discussions. We'd all sit around in groups. But sometimes we'd talk about things that were in the world events, I'm about to say in the charts, we did, that would be overstepping the mark. But we talk about news events or debates. And I remember having all these debates about capital punishment or abortion. But looking back, thinking that that's good in terms of developing a critical mindset and ability to write. But I don't know if, I mean, you know, yeah, of course we read novels and poems and that was all on the curriculum. But I think sometimes we always liked it when the teacher went a little bit off message. But looking back now, if I did that with my students, I'd feel that, it, you know, either I'd feel, oh, I haven't prepared enough, or I'd feel a bit guilty that they might then remember those things, which are good, you know, skills to have, but they don't necessarily belong in that environment. By all means, do this. That should be extracurricular. That should be after school. Incorporate it into the class by all means. But that's what I mean. It's the sort of, but these are the teachers who inspired and made us think that communicating and making us feel that going to school was rewarding because there was something we got out of it, and it engaged with the world outside. That was the crucial thing that really mattered, rather than the sense that we're just reading Shakespeare because we have to, rather than because we want to. I know many people at the age of 12 or 13 were put off Shakespeare for life because they didn't understand King Lear, didn't understand why they had to read it. And of course, in later years, they had no wish then to go back to that because they associate it with a teacher who said, you've misunderstood the play.
Well, do you know what? I think, certainly in secondary school, it was probably my RE teacher that did really inspire me. I know that certainly as in my primary years, RE wasn't something that I looked forward to. It wasn't even taught regularly. I think the cover teacher just... I apologise to that school if that's not true, but I seem to remember it just being something that the supply teacher did when, for whatever reason, our main teacher wasn't in school. So when I actually went to secondary school and found out that RE encompassed so much, and we were really encouraged to have our own opinions. And as you say, actually, we did go a little bit off possibly the lesson plan. And that teacher, I think, kind of showed a bit more of a human side to her. So you could talk to her if you were struggling with something or, you know, or we could talk about the Vicar of Dibley or something. You know, she would relate it to different things in the media that kind of we could relate to a little bit more as well. So she was certainly an inspiration in terms of going on to study religious studies. In terms of going into teaching, I don't know. I don't even think it was as deep as that. It was probably just the fact that I had a teacher for a couple of years, actually. And whenever she taught something, she just made it so clear. I could remember these concepts just clicking in my mind and me just understanding it. And I think that's I kind of wanted to do that for... other people.
Because I often think this comes up in the context of doing a degree, because there are some people who always think, oh, you have to be really clever to do that, or, you know, if you do a PhD, oh, obviously brain box. But actually, it's about assimilating material. It's about having a set of skills. I mean, I wouldn't be good on Mastermind. My old university challenge, I wouldn't know the answer to all the questions. And I'd be like, oh, you know, I should know that. That's sort of within my area. But I suppose there's the difference between knowing everything and then writing an essay. Because writing an essay is a set of skills which has got nothing to do with how much you know.
Well, no, it's not it's not just regurgitating what you know, is it? It's about having that critical argument, and it's about using other people's argument to create your own.
Because one thing I do remember from when you were a student is that you'd look at this source and that source, and you'd read one critically from another. And you were doing things that I hadn't picked up, and you'd say, yeah, but in chapter 4 of that book, this book doesn't fit with a different chapter that maybe the same author or a different author said in another. But you'd bring those two into conversation. And that was highly critical, but of course that's nothing, you know, but that's not something that you would excel on something like Mastermind.
No.
But writing that essay, it just shows that you've got that ability to focus on a source, work your way through it, understand it, and then apply it. And then I think that it's a case of juxtaposing and assimilating and refining and fine-tuning something. But it's nothing that you can do in your head. You can't be sitting on the bus and thinking, oh, that'll be, you know, the conclusion of my piece, whatever. But often you have to be sitting with the resources and then you write it. For me, I don't know about you, I never had this ideal essay in my head. I'd often write it, and it felt like it was writing itself sometimes. But I couldn't, you know, I didn't know what it would look like until I actually had the actual sources in front of me, and they would direct its take. So I couldn't wing it.
No.
People would sometimes say things like, oh, I just wrote the essay, or I suppose people could use the internet. But, you know, for me, it was like, so what if the sources aren't there? The essay is going to be rubbish. Yeah. I've got nothing else to work on. So when did you realise that you had that aptitude? Did it just come into place immediately? Or did you sort of really, was there a lot of slog involved?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely a lot of slog involved. And, yeah, blood, sweat and tears, I think, to do that. And I think a lot of it comes back again from having that real appreciation of just spending, you know, obviously people of all ages at university will do this, but just having that real appreciation of being in the library for hours, for days on end, and finding all these different arguments and having that kind of critical view of them and taking the time to really be able to develop the argument in that way. And actually, you have that stage, don't you, where it's really enjoyable because you've got weeks and weeks and weeks to work on this. And then sometimes it wouldn't come together until like the last week, when I really had to think, like, this is what I'm going to say now. And I don't know what it was. I don't know if it's the adrenaline that eventually kicked in and kind of got me working in the way that I needed to.
But were you somebody who needed, like, the night before, did it all click into place in the sense that you thought, because the deadline's out of hours away, it's now or never? Or were you someone who sort of always sort of like two essays ahead of yourself sort of thing? Could you work better to your own schedule or to the formal one?
I would start working on something pretty much as soon as it was set. But then to actually get the finished piece, I could, you know, I was submitting things hours before it was due kind of thing. So a little bit of both, I think, in terms of starting working on it, it'd be really early. And then it was kind of when it got to really close and the adrenaline and the panic started kicking off. Actually, this argument doesn't work at all. I need to completely change it.
But were there any real sort of discoveries in that? Did you suddenly find that you'd found something out, or you learned something through a particular module that made you just see something differently? It might have been a film, because I know you did the religion and film course.
Yes.
Did you sometimes just think, actually, I mean, sometimes I know some of my students have been put off. They're like, oh, God, I can never go to the cinema now without thinking in a particular way, which actually I'm not trying to get anyone to do. That is actually completely wrong.
Yeah.
It's not a case of this is the way to look at a film. But inevitably, you might start looking at something through a more critical lens if you've written an essay. I get that, because that's just a different sort of mindset thing. And that you don't just sort of think, oh, that's entertainment, this is education. Therefore, you know, sometimes in a module like that, inevitably there's going to be a crossover. But can you remember any particular things that you learned from anything on the degree that made you think, oh my goodness, I wouldn't have thought that was possible, or just something that really inspired you in terms of some of the books that you read, or indeed some of the films that you watched?
It was really lovely, actually, because we had term before last, it was sort of, you can do, the RE lead said, oh, choose some Bible stories to teach this term. So I was like, right, I'm spending all term on Moses, because that is what I did my dissertation on. So we were doing about the I went right from the beginning, finding Moses in the in the bulrushes and things. And it was quite interesting because I hadn't really made this connection about the fact that then the Pharaoh's daughter took him in. And I thought, obviously it was quite hard for me to kind of just gloss over those minor details, but one of my year twos said, well, how, you know, surely she's going to have to hide him now from the Pharaoh. And I was like, yes, you've got it. Yeah. So that was actually a really lovely moment, which I can't take the credit for at all. That was from her own critical thinking.
Yeah, and it's the way in which something that seems really obvious, or the sort of thing that you would be, as an adult, too frightened sometimes to say, because you don't want to look silly, or, you know, the children just get it.
Yes.
And they say it so obviously, you just think, oh yeah, well, maybe we should go with that then, rather than sort of overlook it.
But something that inspired me at the time.
That sort of thirst. I think what I'm trying to get at is that sort of notion of something that makes you just think, you know, rather than just doing it for credit, rather than just doing something because the essay is there, you have to write it. Something that you think, you know, I'm learning something which is kind of transformative. It may not, you know, that might be taking it too far, but just something you just think, actually, this is something which I didn't know I had within me, but you feel that you're making a real contribution to scholarship, or maybe just a personal sense of
I think it was kind of, it developed. So starting from the first year, so, you know, I hadn't written an essay for nearly 10 years, and it certainly wasn't I hadn't done anything in the style that was expected at university at all. I think it was more in the Hindu module that I did, where it kind of just clicked, actually, what was expected from an essay. And so the lecturer, so I went to talk to her about my essay, and she just said, you know, you come up with your own argument and then you weave in. So maybe my first essays was too much talking about the actual sources without much of an argument. But actually, the first, then later in the first year, it was, it clicked more that I was actually weaving those sources in to talk about my own argument.
Yeah, and I think and that's brilliant because you often find in exams as well.
Mm.
How many times a student will struggle over an essay, go over it over and over again, not get it, or find that they just don't know how to bring all the sources together. It just feels really clogged, you know, everything just seems really kind of not fitting and it jars. And then they go into an exam and it's almost this freedom. Because you're doing it under time conditions, but you don't have to worry about bibliography.
You don't have to you haven't got time to think about it,
and you just do it. And I've seen students, I remember actually once, it was many years ago, one colleague said, oh, we want to check for plagiarism, because how can a student write this brilliantly in an exam but not in an essay? It's like, no, this is a student who has that skill, who could just simply, in the time conditions, with the pressure, just do it, but almost being encumbered by those sources. Because that's the other thing, and I find that when I'm writing my own books and so on, sometimes I'm aware that I'm very heavily drawing on other sources. I mean, you have to.
Yes.
But also sometimes it's sort of like, does my own voice come out in this? And some people are brilliant at writing more sort of creatively, in the sense that they will perhaps tell a story to say what they want to say, whereas other people are much more, this scholar says this and that scholar says that. I guess there's no right way of doing it.
No, but I think it was definitely later in that first year I learned more about how to make the essay my own and not just about this is who I've read and what they've said kind of thing.
And then, and I think, and that's what I remember from your work, though, that it's that clear stamp that at the end of it, you're not just regurgitating something. You're clearly making a contribution and you're doing something that nobody else could, well, other people could do, but you're the
just
one who's
that bringing argument,
that particular argument.
Yeah.
But you know, if you're using different sources, you might have chosen something differently. But it's that sort of, you know, higher sort of critical skill. But what about things that were going on in the background? Mm-hmm. We mentioned music earlier. Did that sort of carry, not to the point of listening to the charts every Sunday?
No.
But what about music or film? What sort of influences did they have, if at all, while you were, for example, at university?
I do. It's funny. I do quite like the radio rather than just listen to a CD, because you kind of feel like, this sounds really weird, but you've got someone talking to you and you're part of that community of listeners. So like, I drive my husband crazy because I'm completely obsessed with Friends. It's really not. I mean, I come home from work and I turn on Comedy Central. It's the same as I was playing over and over again, but it's just a really nice, just come home and relax to. I've got them all on DVD, but it's not the same as watching them on TV.
Yeah.
I know that sounds a bit strange.
No, not at all.
So, yes, I probably am a bit more of a radio person. In terms of, can I go right back, actually? So when I was, so this is when the first Toy Story film came out, and I was taking my 11 plus, and I used to watch Toy Story every single night, and it just kind of kept me calm.
Yeah.
So that was so now I don't want to. Have you seen Toy Story 4?
I have. I saw it very recently. Oh, that's one that I didn't put up a review of. So you're probably thinking Chris couldn't have seen it. No, because I went to it with my children, but I was watching them.
What did you think of the end? I was a bit distraught.
Remind me of the end.
I have to say. So Woody says goodbye to the toys because he wants to go off with Bo Peep, and he says goodbye to. But it's just wrong. It's all wrong. They could have, you know.
One of my children. I think it was one of my daughters. Said to me at one point in the film, they're going to get married. And I just thought, what a funny thing to say. But I think they kind of did, didn't they? Or certainly that possibility
was open.
They were then
in a romance, weren't
they? But that, you know, and that's coming from a five-year-old.
Yeah.
I thought, I don't know where this is going.
But it's like, and that's my whole childhood over. They've either got to make a... Yeah. It's funny because obviously that was kind of like a big part of that period of time. Yeah. So now in my mind, I feel that they've almost got to make a Toy Story 5 and have them reunited, or I'll just have to watch the first one again to kind of get that element of my childhood back.
But what you said about... There's something interesting about repetition in what you were just talking about, that sense of every night you had to watch the same film.
Yes.
But there are some people who will say, but you've already seen that film. Why would you go and watch it again? But I say, you know, what sort of music do you like? Imagine they said, I know, Elvis, I don't know. Say, right, what's your favourite Elvis song? I don't know, Wooden Heart. Would you then switch the radio off if it came on because you already know it? Well, of course,
exactly.
That would just be weird.
Yeah.
So in the same way, well, if something makes an impact on you, then repetition, or that becoming a part of your narrative.
Yes, yeah.
So watching a film 20, 30, 40 times is completely normal if it, you know, look at Star Wars fans, you know, I saw Groundhog Day at the cinema, but it was 26 actually since it came out, and they showed it twice, back to back, and I went along and, you know, thought, because I'm seeing it twice and it's going to be a long evening, it was only about 2 weeks ago, I thought, okay, So I don't want to take, you know, so I maybe have had like a hot dog or something, but I planned it so that when I went the second time, I'd have some popcorn or something. So I just, you know, spread the evening out. So I went to see the film. I knew they were showing it back to back, so I hurried to the toilet and went to the confectionery and went in. No one else there. The second one, even though it was booked as a double bill, no one else went. I thought, aww. But that's the whole point. I mean, I don't mind. I'm often going to the cinema. I'm the only one. Yeah. I'm not worried about that. But it was more, because often when I go, I'm as much aware of the people around as I am of the film, which is why I can never write a review if I've got my children with me, because I really cannot watch the film. I'm watching their response to the film. So
I suppose going back to the repetition, it's watching those Friends repeats, isn't it? Because it has that, I mean, even when I, you know, so I was quite strict with myself when I was doing an essay, you know, I'd be upstairs in the study or in the library or whatever. I didn't actually have any music playing kind of at the time, but something that I could then, you know, on a break escape to would be episodes of Friends.
Yeah.
And it might have been the same one that I watched the previous day.
But what you said about radio is interesting, because if I know that a programme has been pre-recorded, and something you just do know because there's no interaction with the newsreader or the travel presenter or something, it's a no-no for me, because I think it's like a lecture. Imagine if you were a student again and you were meant to have a class with me at 2 p.m. and you go into the room and find out that I'm not there, but I pre-recorded the lecture and it's on the screen. And something, you know. Now, I don't know about you, but I would, if I was the student in that room, I would feel a little bit cheated, but also a sense of there's no interactivity.
So you can't ask questions.
And some people might prefer that.
And also, you're not then able to respond to maybe questions that students are asking.
And also, my delivery would be a little bit sort of out of sync, because when I'm teaching, I'm always aware of the, I have to be aware of the audience in the room. Whereas if I've pre-recorded it, then I might sound too formal. I might be speaking a bit too fast. But also, I would probably just go on and on and on and on, because I wouldn't know whether I was taking everyone with me, and I couldn't stop and say, you're all okay, because they couldn't respond back. Even though the radio presenter doesn't know, they can't see the audience, I think Sarah Kennedy used to say this, that, you know, she'd always have one listener in her head. There was one person listening.
Yeah.
It may not even be gendered, but it's just that there is some, you know, imaginary audience person, and that is the listener. And that's the person that you're speaking to. And so every million, you know, one of the many millions who might actually be listening will feel that they are being spoken to directly and feel that you're having a conversation with that presenter. And that has taken me through, and I'm sure that's probably one of the reasons I've ended up teaching as well, because of that radio communication. And it feels like you and that person are the most important people in the room.
Yes.
The downside, of course, is when you perhaps, and it happened with film stars, people will watch a film and feel like, in the Woody Allen film, The Purple Rose of Cairo, when Cecilia goes to the same film every day and she ends up being sucked up into the film because she's like, you know, even the actors are saying, hang on a minute, you were here last night. And suddenly it's like, it's breaking the fourth wall. But with radio as well, there is just a level of intimacy which I don't think any other media can achieve. And I think that that, for me, is the optimum form of communicating, whether it's as a lecturer, a broadcaster, as a teacher. But are there particular, you mentioned Mark Goodyear, but with the charts, but are there any particular radio presenters or stations or sort of particular memories that you have, you know, either from childhood or
definitely. Or in 80 years? So after school, you'd have on Radio 1, you'd have Chris Moyles and Comedy Dave. Yeah, they were definitely a big part of my teenage years. After school every day, I'd put the radio on and they would be on. I don't know if I've got to the eight. I listen to Heart now because I'm that much older. And Radio 1, I probably wouldn't know half the songs on it.
Were you sort of like a breakfast show person as well? Would there be a particular programme?
So in the morning, I'd normally have the big breakfast.
Yeah. On the TV?
On the TV.
Who was the presenter at that point? I remember when Chris Evans started
It was Chris Evans and Gabby Rossing who started it. And then after that, there was Denise Van Outen and Mark Little.
Yeah, and there was Johnny as well.
Johnny Vaughan. That's it. Johnny Vaughan came in and did that. So, yeah.
I remember they did that terrible duet with, you know, the Kylie and Jason song with Denise Van Outen and Johnny Vaughan.
I don't remember that.
But what about other things at university? I mean, my sense is, and I often say this with people here, that a decade ago it felt that if ever I gave political analogies or referred to things that were happening in the news, elections, if there was an election going on, I never sort of got the sense that resonated with students. I feel it very different now, particularly the last two or three years in Canterbury. Certainly politically, it's the students who changed the course of election history with the first Labour MP. But did that sort of resonate at all when you were a student? Were you sort of aware of some, you know, a lot of students might go on marches or might be sort of really sort of committed to particular causes. But
yeah.
Is that? But my sense is that a lot of that is coming back now, but a decade or so ago, it really didn't sort of... I never really got the sense that what was going on in the news sort of kind of mattered in the way that perhaps social media helps with this as well.
I think so. And I think there's a lot of the fact that we need to start looking after the environment, that it's time for people to make changes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of that is coming through because there was a lot of even school children, like teenagers, doing marches in London about environmental change and how important it is to them. So I think there's a lot of awareness from their point of view. That if there aren't changes made, then their world when they're older is going to be very different from now, if that makes sense.
That's really interesting because I know of some people who've got children in primary or I don't know whether it's primary or secondary school, but suddenly the children wanted to go on the environmental march, climate change a few months ago, and the teachers said that if they did, they'd be in detention or they'd be in trouble. Yeah. But that was really interesting.
Yeah. Because a lot of it might just be because they didn't want to do double science in the afternoon or something.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of them still are aware that that it's important for them to have an opinion and it's important for them to use their vote in a certain way.
Yeah.
I know from my point of view, kind of when I was a little bit younger, like when I was, you know, first able to vote, I was really passionate and really confident about who I wanted to vote for. And I'd really look forward to going to the village hall and putting my vote through and thinking, yep, I've done the right thing. And now I just think, I don't want to waste my vote. But who do I really believe in? Mm. And I think now I find it more difficult to choose who it is I'm going to vote for.
Because often people see it the other way around, because there were times, certainly I first voted in 92, and at the time, there was often a perception, oh, they're all the same. I'd only ever grown up with a Conservative government. I was when Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister.
She was my first Prime Minister.
Yeah, I was five going on six. So I don't remember Jim Callaghan. So the first time there was a Labour government was in 97.
That was Tony Blair, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I was already 24.
Mm.
So it felt like a big deal. But the 92 election looked like it might be won by Labour. And there was something...
It's like John Major.
Yeah, and Neil Kinnock, that's right, yeah. So it looked as though there might be... You know, after 13 years doesn't sound so much now, but when you're like 18, 13 years is a very long time. But that is interesting, isn't it? But these days, of course, a lot of the time, because politics has become so much more unpredictable, so much more volatile, there's a sense in which voting for a fringe party candidate, actually that candidate might end up winning in a way that was, you know, we had in 92, there was the Natural Law Party. They were never going to win. And they were sort of seen as being a bit like the Monster Raving Loony Party, a bit of a joke party. However, these days, you know, candidates, as long as their message is very clear and they're very confident, then, you know, surprisingly, you know, upsets do happen. So the whole sort of like two and then became three-party politics just, you know, was thrown out the window many years ago. But what about doing religious studies? Because obviously this must be the question that you always get. Why study that for your degree?
Yes, you're going to be a nun or you're going to be a vicar.
Do you have any like really awful experiences of that? For me, supermarket is the worst place.
Okay.
Being at the checkout and then being asked, so why are you doing that degree? Because I think I can stand up in front of a class and talk about the death of God for 3 hours, or whatever the topic might be, go to the supermarket, and you're on somebody else's turf. Because they're the ones in control. They've got the power.
Yes.
It's their space, and I'm the customer. But I always find that I really don't want anybody to ask me that question. It's interesting to me to unpack that. But the sound of it, you've had kind of similar experiences?
Yeah, I think I took my car for an MOT, and they said, oh, you've been at work today. I said, oh, no, I'm a student. What are you studying? Religious studies? Oh, you're going to be a vicar, you know. Yeah. That kind of thing. And some people just question why you would do that, you know, or they would say, what can you do with that? In a way that maybe they wouldn't ask you that if you did something like English literature or, you know, another humanity or a subject that doesn't necessarily lead to a specific career.
Because I'm guessing that when you were doing the degree, and you could tell me that I'm wrong on this, but I'm going to guess that you very rarely spoke, not you personally, but, you know, the students didn't really talk to the other students about the sort of, do you believe in God or whatever?
No.
Because in a way, there's no need to do that because you will know that you're studying something.
Yes.
For, you know, and the goal is to get a degree, and you've chosen that for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah.
But you're not there because it's about proving the existence. You might look at the arguments for the existence of God, but, you know, and of course there are students with a faith position, and there are many without, and many agnostic. But it's interesting that outside, you think that would be the space when everyone would be saying, so what do you believe? What do you believe? Do you have a faith? But I'll step into McDonald's and I get that question asked of me.
Okay.
So why are you doing what you're doing?
Yeah.
Do you have and I find that really intriguing.
Mm.
So the best way not to talk about your faith is within a religious studies or theology classroom, because then everybody knows that that's in a way
something separate.
It's separate to that.
And people would even ask me, so which religion are you going to choose?
Yeah.
I was like, what do you mean? And they'd sort of think that, you know, the lecturer's jobs was to convert you to whichever religion you were studying, which was a bit bizarre.
I thought that's really interesting, because when I was teaching you because some lecturers do not give, it wouldn't be obvious if they do have a faith position,
didn't know at all. So
it's not even on the radar.
No.
I suppose you could be doing a course on Jane Austen, and the tutor might be the biggest Jane Austen fan in the world. I suppose I can see how there might be a perception that if you say something critical, but in a way, though, as I say to my students, if you take my arguments apart, well, that's good, because that's why you're here. If you were only here just to, as if like I am the authority, and anything that's not, that's not really what education at this level is about.
I guess in any subject, if you disagree, or if you put a view forward where you disagree with maybe what the lecturer says, you might have to prove yourself more by bringing in a certain argument, maybe. I don't know, because everyone's got that kind of bias, haven't they?
Yeah.
But that's not exclusive to religious studies.
No, some more philosophically based questions just to round off. Would you say, Sarah, that your memories, at any point, there's no sort of like fixed period, predominantly positive?
I think that people tend to look at the past through rose-tinted spectacles, and I don't know if everyone does this, but you tend to categorise memories into, when I was working here, when I was at school here, when I was at university here, and your mind filters out the positive memories, doesn't it? It doesn't, you can't remember every sort of mundane day-to-day experience. Of course, there are memories where you can't do that with. It might be the death of a loved one or something else that's traumatic. But I think on the whole, looking back, I would say that it is positive. Not to say that it wasn't, but I think part of the reason for that is because of the way that our brain remembers things, and you have this kind of collection. It becomes almost a highlight reel when you look back and remember it.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think that sometimes it's easy. Like, I've just run a conference over the last few days. It was excruciatingly hot. I was the whole time thinking, how are we going to get through the rest of the day in this heat? But somehow, in months or years to come, I'll probably look back and think, oh yeah, that was really, it was the
such
hottest day of the year. The sun was shining, and there was a real sort of vibrancy in the room, because we'd all come together. Yeah, it was hot, but there was a lot of intellectual heat as well as the meteorological heat. But it's funny, but it was a stressful conference, but because it's finished, it was, I like to think, successful. Then in that sense, you remember that, and the fact that there were bits of it that were horrible, you kind of whitewash.
Yes, you do. And I don't know if
your degree would be a good example, perhaps. I bet there were times when you thought, I can't do this, it's horrible.
Definitely.
But you got a very good degree. So I'm hoping and assuming that you're looking back thinking, it was an amazing experience.
Do you know what? When I walked from the car park, and I walked into that square bit, so you've got the gold bench in there, and there's the law school, isn't there? And I just remember that feeling I had when I first turned up, having given up my full-time job and just came here to study, that feeling of excitement, and that just, that all came back to me as I walked onto this. I mean, I've been here quite a few times since, but I don't know if it's because I knew that I was coming to this, that I had, I wonder what memories are going to come back, but that definitely hit. And I think when I do look back at my time here, I do remember the lectures, the seminars, the lunches with my friends, and you do tend to filter out that time when you're with this essay and you don't really know what you're doing with it, and the deadline's in a week and you're stressing. I think you do. Is that a coping mechanism, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
Possibly.
But often it's those little incidental details as well, isn't it? That sometimes I was talking to a former student, well, before you came here, and he'd been on a trip to the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And he said, you know, he was really excited about it. It's one of the wonders of the world. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, what an amazing trip this is going to be. But he said he was on a rickety old coach with lots of other tourists shouting and pushing. And he said when he got there, they looked and he just thought, and that's it. It was so underwhelming. And he was like, it's supposed to be one of the wonders of the world.
Yeah.
And I said, what happened afterwards? He said, we went back to the hotel, had a coffee or a beer or something. And I thought, was that the best bit of the trip? He said, you bet. And you think you've got all the, you know, not the other side of the world, but, you know, to another country.
Mm.
And the thing you remember most is just sitting in a nice air-conditioned room having a beer. But that is it. And as being a student, the fondest memories I have are not necessarily the grand occasions. Of course, the degree ceremonies, they all matter hugely.
Yeah, definitely.
But often it's the little incidental or accidental things, like playing. I mean, I can't play pool to save my life, but I used to play it with friends of an evening, and that was our way to unwind with a video jukebox. And, you know, in the early 90s as well. So there was lots of sort of Shakespeare Sister and Whitney Houston, and it would come on. And that's the stuff I remember most. Mm. And it's the sort of thing that there was no fuss involved. It wasn't like a big organised event. It was the fact that it was sort of, let's just see what happens, let's see how the evening unfolds. And those are the memories that you take with you. But those same people, if you were to mention those, they might think, that's, you know, be more specific.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and that's the thing. So everyone will take something different, you know, from based on what they're going through at the time in terms of how stressed they are or whether they're ahead of schedule or behind schedule with their work. Would you say that you fulfilled the dreams that you had from when you were young? Or to put it another way, have you ever dreamt about doing something different that may be in keeping with what you dreamed about doing as a child or at university?
So, obviously, I've become a primary school teacher, which I told my mum I was going to do when I was five. In some ways, I do. It's difficult because sometimes I think, oh, you know, I could have been doing this for 10 years now. But I've only been doing it, you know, I'm 35 next year. I've only been doing it for 2 years and I've got the wage to match it, kind of thing. Yeah. If I'd have done it earlier, there is a lot of stress to it. There's a lot of accountability. Would I have managed that maybe as much? I'm not saying I manage it really well now, but would I have been even worse if I'd have done it when I was younger? But the fact that I have done it at all means, you know, at least I can say that I have done it, kind of thing. So, yes, I think in my early 30s, I've been able to right a lot of the wrongs that I'd made in my 20s by not going to university, by not just getting on with it and doing what I wanted to do. So I guess that kind of means there's still a lot more to achieve. There's still a lot more to learn in terms of my teaching. And there's still a lot of skills that I need to work on. So I guess you always learn as a teacher, not only because things are changing, but because you can never be 100% perfect. I hope sort of in the immediate future that I do just keep improving on my practice in that kind of way. I don't know, maybe 1 year they'll pay for me to go on sabbatical and I'll go and do a master's in religion. That'd be amazing.
Oh, no, you'd be good at that. And then you could study in more detail the film. I always associate this with you, but when I asked you to do this, it's one of the things I always associate with you. When I had that poll, you went to the talk once and everyone had to vote for their favourite Christmas movie.
Oh, the Christmas Party.
Yeah, and in, God, 2014 that would have been.
Yep.
And I remember your answer. Do you want to tell the world?
So the I think I was I the only person that voted for this?
Not necessarily. Oh, well, I'll answer that in a minute because it depends. But somebody misspelled this. The film that you're going to say.
Oh, okay, yes. It could be confused with others.
It could be confused with The Santa Claus.
Yes, but, the one that I voted for was Santa Claus the Movie.
Yeah.
And I voted for that film because it was a film that I grew up with. I think it came out the year I was born.
Yeah, I remember you saying, yeah.
And so certainly in my household, when we were younger, Christmas started in October. I got my dad to get out the VHS of Santa Claus the Movie. Yeah. And I guess, I don't know, I like doing things over and over again. I would watch it over and over and over again. And now it's almost like it doesn't feel like Christmas unless I've watched that film. And then sometimes if it's all a bit crazy before Christmas and I haven't watched it, it's too late. I can't watch it on Boxing Day. No. It has to be before Christmas Day.
No, that's one of those big taboos about Christmas as well. The build up to Christmas is huge. You mentioned October. But once you hit Boxing Day, and suddenly this, it feels inappropriate. And I actually spent a period, two or three summers ago, of listening back through a number of old radio programmes. I recorded it as part of my research. I wrote an article on this. So it was June and July, hot time of year, and I was listening to Christmas programmes from a whole variety of stations where they were all talking about Santa Claus in the sky and, you know, is he going to come and deliver his presents? But it felt like a taboo. It felt like I shouldn't be listening. It felt like that it's almost as though this was earmarked for a particular time and place. And when you're outside of that, you've got no business being part of that.
No, I think...
Because that community is gone.
It's a bit like when you're listening to that radio show or you're watching that programme on the television and there's lots of other people doing it. Is it because you're... When you... I don't know, if you played a Christmas song or put a Christmas film on in March or even the beginning of January, there's nobody else doing it. Yeah. And it's also because Christmas is such a sacred time. Mm. There's such a small pocket, I think, that actually if you did... something to do with Christmas outside of that time. I don't know, it's just wrong somehow.
That's what made me write the book on this, because I've got old I record stuff from the radio, lots of Christmas songs. I just listen to it on a loop, you know, so it might be June and I'm listening to Frosty the Snowman. But this is the thing, I've never been very good at organising Christmas, or, you know, I'm not somebody who then, because I'm studying Christmas, is suddenly like completely, you know, months ahead of everybody else in terms of buying the presents and putting up decorations. And at one time I was living somewhere where the neighbours, on the 1st of December, without fail, would put up their lights. Bit of a nuisance, if I'm honest. But at least, well, yeah, you see your way in the dark, that's for sure. But and I used to feel very ambivalent about this, because it almost felt as though it was obviously not my festival, but because I've chosen to study this, somehow it's almost as though that was intruding. It's almost as though in doing that, they were sort of like ahead of me on my own festival. I was studying this all year round and quite aware of the transgressions and the taboos. And suddenly here they were, 1st of December, that's when Christmas started for them. And I kind of felt that I was out of step, you know, on, I can't say my own season, but the season that was part of my study. And it made me feel very sort of out of step. Did you ever have any experiences like that? I mean, look, you mentioned it with Santa Claus. You have to get all these films in by Christmas Day.
It's like Love Actually. I mean, you can't watch that on Boxing Day. I don't know. I think it's because those films, they sort of... going back to kind of looking at the past through kind of these rose-tinted spectacles, they just sort of bring back memories that you had of Christmas, because obviously you do remember just the good times, unless obviously something traumatic happened. And they always stop, don't they, on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. They never go beyond that. So it's all really happy and jolly. And I think sometimes you want to live that feeling that you get from watching the film, but you never get the kind of the downer that they have on the 27th of December. You never get that in the film.
I always feel the best person, or maybe the worst, to make a Christmas movie would be Woody Allen, because he would kind of start, in the same way with Christmas Carol, I guess. Imagine if a Christmas Carol didn't end on Boxing Day, because would Scrooge... Is his transformation... We're meant to believe that he's changed for life. That Christmas miracle... has changed him forever.
But, or has it?
But we don't know, of course, that's for us to read into it. But my sense is that, and of course he jokes with Bob Cratchit the next, on Christmas Day, that he's like, I'm going to raise your wages, but Bob thinks he's going to be fired.
Yes.
Because he didn't go into work on Christmas Day. You cannot maintain that level of, that peak experience, shall we say, forever.
No.
Because, you know, in life, we all have, by definition, ups and downs. You know, if you're writing an essay, of course, there'll be times when you think, I'm really happy with something, and then other times when you're more, you know, self-critical. But we're meant to believe that this person who has sort of lost his path, this individual who's misanthropic, the person who's sort of not very good at engaging with other people, not very nice to other people, has suddenly had this conversion, which means he's effectively a different person. And that has to be maintained for the rest of his life. And I mean, and that's sort of in keeping with the sort of the, what Christmas is about. But of course, you don't get the next day. You just assume that that's what you aim for. But in reality, what does happen at Christmas? You often meet up with family members. You often have, there are often sort of tensions over one reason or another.
Fall asleep by 3 o'clock.
But also, you have to at some point go back to the real world. You have to go back to your jobs and the routine.
That's why you get that downer, isn't it?
That's the thing. And that's why they say there's a particular date in January. It's like the third Monday.
Blue Monday or something, isn't it?
That's the one.
And it, I was thinking about this because I went to New York on like the 22nd of December last year. And on the flight, I watched Miracle on 34th Street. And you know, I just felt so excited because, oh, this is what New York's going to be like. And to be fair, we were... getting a cruise ship from there, so I didn't spend a lot of time in New York. But you know, I was thinking about the ending where the mum and the guy get together and she's having a baby and everything, but does it stay that happy forever?
Yeah.
No, you never find out.
And in a way, it doesn't matter, because that's for us to read into it.
Yes.
But I agree with you that sometimes it would be nice if somebody made a film. In the same way, I've always said that, you know, Tarantino should make a Jesus film, because it would upset the balance.
Mm.
It would be very different. But at least it would make people sort of question that, rather than the sort of... Because, you know, we watch these films, which probably make us feel worse in a way, because we aspire for Christmas to be wonderful. We look yes. forward to Christmas. But often,
is it because the films have made that, made it that way?
But there's this mismatch, but we keep going back for more. My grandfather always used to say, he was in his 90s, and he'd say, I'm just having beans on toast next Christmas, I can't deal with all this. But he never did.
No.
That's the crucial bit. He always threatened it. And I believed him. And
you always want that movie Christmas, don't you?
Yeah. And if you don't get that, what happens? So I think you're right.
And I guess there's no movie for the time between the 27th of December and the 2nd of January. So there's, I don't know, is there nothing to aspire to in terms of...
I suppose there's a few New Year, sort of like When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah.
But you're right, yeah, that deal or the Hudsucker Proxy, you're right. That sort of period. But they are not necessarily Christmas movies. So when I mention those two films, they're not the ones that normally appear on the list. So you're right, a Christmas movie normally ends on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
With a big meal, and there's always reconciliation. Even Bad Santa, if you've seen that film, where you've got Billy Bob Thornton.
I might have seen bits of it.
It's like the anti-Christmas Christmas movie.
Yeah.
But even then, there's a conversion experience at the end. It follows the same... And I don't know whether it's meant to be ironic, but it follows the same pattern as the Scrooge story.
Yeah.
Yeah, just an updated version where he swears a lot. And it literally deserves its 18 rating. Okay, just two more questions. Are you in touch with friends from your past?
Yes. Yeah. Not many, like not everybody kind of thing. Yeah. So I'm probably in touch with one person from school. Although it's quite funny because we live around the corner from each other, and we still see each other maybe four times a year.
Yeah.
But we're still in regular touch and still have lots to talk about when we see each other. And I'm still in touch with one person from university, probably more occasional than we thought it was going to be. But I guess that's just one of those things, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I found that because I do the whole reunion thing now. It took me I had to step away in order to go back, if that makes sense. Because I'd lived in the same university town for 10 years, did all my degrees there. And I had like an undergraduate experience and a postgraduate experience.
Mm.
I think I had to step away for a long period in order to go back, only for small periods, like over a weekend. But that's it. There's all the difference in the world between doing that and returning to that same structure, which I could never do. I could never go back that far. But you pick up on these conversations and you realise you've got all these amazing things in common.
Yeah.
My very last question, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Probably look back more than I should, but I think you can learn things from looking back. Looking forward, I try not to look, I think you get a sense of panic when you look forward too far. Like, I think it's a bit scary thing trying to plot out the rest of your life, because you kind of don't want there to be an end to that plan, do you? But I do, now I think that I'm more kind of satisfied in what I'm doing, so I'm doing something that I have always wanted to do. I do now try to look forward more back.
And maybe then this would be the ideal. So if you do that Masters, that'd be...
Imagine
your life as a Christmas movie, critically assess.
Yes! That would be good. That'd be amazing.
It has been amazing to catch up with you.
Yes, it's lovely to see you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.